at doctrine, the application of salvation to our lives. In our evening sermons, we've been exposed to instruction in the book of James, relentless, hard-hitting instruction. What we need tonight, therefore, is some narrative, I think, to balance things up a bit, and where better to go for a dose of raw, full-blooded narrative than 2 Samuel chapter 6. So that's where we're going to plant ourselves for the next few minutes. And there are 3 things that I want to highlight there, and I'll just warn you, we'll spend the longest on the first, because we need to ground ourselves and understand what's going on in this passage. And so, first of all then, this evening, clear separation. That's my first heading, clear separation. So let's not beat about the bush. The issue which really grabs our attention in this chapter, even more than Uzzah's demise, is David's attire. As we think of David's life, I suppose that many of us have in our minds 2 columns. One has the heading low points, the other has the heading high points. In the low points column, there's David's sex with Bathsheba and elimination of her husband. There's his ill-judged plan to wipe out Nabal and his entire household. There's his disrespect toward those soldiers who have just defeated his rival Absalom there on the battlefield. Those episodes are in the low points column. In the high points column, there's David's defeat of Goliath. There's his sparing of King Saul on a couple of occasions when he has the opportunity to kill him. There's his sensitive and protective treatment of those servants of his who have been humiliated by King Hanan of the Ammonites. Those episodes are in the high points column. But the incident here in 2 Samuel 6, David dancing in this particular garb, I don't suppose it ends up in the same column in every Christian's mind. Some Christians put it in the high points column. Here's David so taken up with God that everything else becomes irrelevant to him, even the fact that he's revealing too much of himself. How wonderful to be that unself-conscious and self-forgetful in joyful worship. If excitement about a scientific principle made Archimedes so oblivious to issues of personal modesty, then how much more should excitement about God have that effect? That's how some people see it. Other Christians, however, put it very firmly in the low points column. Modesty in relation to the body is a fundamental biblical ethic, and fervor and spontaneity in worship must never violate fundamental biblical ethics. Otherwise, it's just wild pagan frenzy, like the prophets of Baal cutting themselves on Mount Carmel. David here is out of order. His state of undress brings the worship of Yahweh into disrepute. So those are 2 contrasting ways that Christian readers handle this. And it seems to me that in both cases, the underlying premise is incorrect. Both approaches just assume something. They assume that David's attire is skimpy and revealing. And I reject that starting point. Here are 3 reasons why I reject it: the clothing, the critic, and the context. First, the clothing. David is wearing a linen ephod, we're told, in verse 14. Now, I'm no expert in the clothing of the ancient Near East, I admit that, but nor, I suspect, most of those who like to portray David here as doing something terribly racy and risque. What I do know is that the wearers of linen ephods in 1 Samuel 22:18 are a bunch of priests, which to me doesn't suggest that it's a questionable kind of garment. So I'm saying David isn't wearing a flimsy loincloth or something like that. He's wearing an item whose other appearances in the Bible arouse no suspicion in our minds. We've no reason to think a linen ephod was anything other than a thoroughly respectable, wholly unremarkable piece of clothing. So that's the clothing. Secondly, the critic. Where has this idea of David dancing in an indecent manner come from? Where have readers of this passage derived that image? Well, David has a critic in this passage. It's his wife, Michal. And it's her criticism then in verse 20 that has given rise to the popular understanding of this scene, the notion of David here exposing himself. But has her criticism been rightly interpreted? Certainly something about David's conduct has greatly upset her. And it's also true that the dominant term in her outburst there in verse 20 is the verb uncover. It's actually used three times in the Hebrew text of verse 20, not just twice. Literally, she says, "How the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, female servants, uncovering himself as one of the vulgar fellows uncovers himself." So on the face of things, then, it all seems pretty clear, doesn't it? Michal is upset. She repeatedly refers to David uncovering himself. It must be her husband's immodesty that's troubling her. But before jumping to such conclusions, we need to do some careful thinking. Who is this woman, Michal? Well, I've referred to her as David's wife, and she is that. But that's not how the narrator here refers to her. Verse 16, Michal, the daughter of Saul. Verse 20, Michal, the daughter of Saul. Verse 23, Michal, the daughter of Saul. I think that the narrator is trying to tell us that Michal is the daughter of Saul. Now, here's my question. Might Michal's connection with Saul, which the narrator is clearly so keen to stress, might that cause her to detest David's attire here for a different reason than that it was skimpy and revealing? Let's think about Saul for a moment. Now, we all know, don't we, that Saul turned out bad. But how? What was the problem with Saul? Well, Saul's problem was this. He became increasingly puffed up and self-important. One fact about Saul that is little known, because it's mentioned very fleetingly by the author of 1 Samuel, speaks volumes about the man. He erected a monument for himself. We're told that in 1 Samuel 15, verse 12. That's how high a view Saul had of his own status and significance. He erected a monument for himself. And in that spirit of self-importance, Saul went around wearing a royal robe. A robe that declared to everyone, "I have royal status." It's why in 1 Samuel 15, 27 and 28, Samuel tears Saul's robe. And then announces, "Thus has the Lord torn the kingdom of Israel from you." It isn't that Samuel at that moment just grasped at the first thing he saw that would tear easily and be a good visual aid. And he could have made his point equally well had he pulled a piece of paper out of his pocket and torn that. No, the robe was the great symbol of Saul's royal status. That's why Samuel, prophesying the demise of Saul's kingship, targeted the robe. It's why in 1 Samuel 24, verses 4 to 6, David is so conscience-stricken, you remember, for having cut off a corner of Saul's robe. I mean, you read that and it seems a bit odd, doesn't it? David must have the most tender conscience in the whole world to be so bothered about having cut a corner off Saul's robe. What's the big deal about that? But again, you see, the robe was the great symbol of Saul's royal status. Cutting it was effectively a challenge to that royal status, and so David regretted it greatly. It's related to all of this as well when Jonathan, in 1 Samuel 18, verse 4, gives his robe to David, presumably as a member of the royal household and ostensibly the next in line to the throne. He too had a similar robe to his father's. And handing it over to David then was him acknowledging that David was in fact God's choice to be the next king, not him, Jonathan. So I'm saying Saul's kingship was a swaggering kingship. It was a kingship that liked to flaunt itself by means of royal robes. And here's Michal. And she's Saul's daughter, the narrator keeps telling us. She's from that stable, we might say. She represents that approach to monarchy. And I would put it to you, therefore, that what disgusts Michal as she sees David on this huge national occasion, the return of the ark, wearing a linen ephod, what disgusts Michal isn't his lack of clothing. What he had on was perfectly adequate in terms of modesty. It's his lack of showy, kingly, status-affirming clothing. It isn't that David is being too lewd for her liking. It's that David is being too lowly for her liking. Her concern isn't that he should do more to conceal his body. It's that he should do more to lay bare his royal position. In her mind, kings shouldn't wear the simple clothing of the hoipoloi, or the vulgar fellows, as she calls them. It's beneath them. It's humiliating. It's undignified. She wants David to enter the city in an impressive display of regal pomp, just the way that her father Saul would have done. So that's the clothing and the critic. And then the third thing, the context. I want to suggest that it's particularly important for David here to enter Jerusalem in as un-Saul-like a way as he possibly can, wearing something just very plain and very unkingly. You see, David has just flirted himself a little with Saul's swaggering model of kingship. That, I think, is what's going on in verses 1 to 11 of this chapter. Several things about David's conduct in those verses are very troubling. Most basically of all, there's the fact that he does not transport the Ark of the Covenant in the way the law of Moses required the Ark of the Covenant to be transported. You can read in Numbers chapter 4 about how it was meant to be transported. All the stuff of the tabernacle was meant to be transported with poles. It was meant to be carried. And here's David, and what does he do? He sticks the Ark of the Covenant on a cart. Clearly David thought that he was so important, he didn't have to worry about those little details in the law of Moses. He was above all that. That's actually very like Saul, isn't it? You think of Saul in 1 Samuel 15, and he's been commanded to go and wipe out the Amalekites and all the stuff belonging to the Amalekites, devote them all to complete destruction. And Samuel turns up after the battle, and he can hear sheep bleating. What's this? Why haven't you destroyed everything? Ah, well, I'm going to offer sacrifices to the Lord with it. Sounded so good, so pious, so impressive. That's not what the Lord had commanded. But Saul, you see, he regards himself as above these little details that the Lord has stipulated. And David seems to be flirting frighteningly with that kind of mentality here in this chapter. Indeed, there's that strange detail in verse 1 where we're told that in order to transport the ark, David gathered 30,000 men. It doesn't take 30,000 men to transport a cart with the Ark of the Covenant. It's almost as though David is saying, look, with my military prowess and my resources, my army, my 30,000 soldiers, I defy even Yahweh to mess around with my ark transportation plan. There seems to be something of that defiant spirit about David. And then there's verse 8, and Uzzah has been struck down. Poor Uzzah is a victim of David's arrogance and self-importance and his oblivion to the details of the law of Moses. Uzzah has been struck down. And what's David's response in verse 8? Is he penitent? Is he humbled? Does he cry out for mercy to God? No, he's angry. He has the temerity to be angry with God for what has happened. And then there's his language in verse 9 as well. David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? Almost as if the ark is this personal possession that he wants near him, this prop for his own use. The singular me there is somewhat disturbing, I think. So all in all, it looks like in the first half of this chapter, David's royal position has somewhat gone to his head. He's morphing into another Saul before our very eyes. It's very concerning. And I think then what happens between verse 11 and verse 12 is that David himself thankfully realizes the path that he's going down, and he repents of that path. And now, in his second attempt to bring the ark to Jerusalem, he goes to the other extreme, not merely getting the law of Moses' details right this time, verse 13, clearly the ark is carried this time, not put on a cart. Not only that, but renouncing this time all the trappings of kingship, dispensing with his royal robe, and just donning a very plain, very ordinary linen ephod. He's making a clear separation from his predecessor, certainly, but also, I think, from his own recent flirtation with self-important behavior. So I hope you get all of that then. I'm saying to you, please discard this idea that David here is dancing in a way that throws modesty to the wind. You might like that idea because you deem it exuberant worship. You might detest that idea because you deem it unseemly. But either way, I'm saying it's irrelevant, actually, because David doesn't dance in that way. He's dressed decently, but plainly. That's the point. And he's dressed plainly in a way that so disgusts Michal. He's dressed plainly in order to make this clear separation from Saul's type of conduct and from his own recent Saul-like conduct. Clear separation. Secondly, continued self-abasement. Continued self-abasement. So Michal, as we said, is disgusted by David's lack of regal pomp, and she addresses him there in verse 20. And notice then David's response in verses 21 and 22, and particularly those very striking words in verse 22, where he says to her, I will make myself yet more contemptible than this. I prefer the NIV and New King James rendering of that. I will be even more undignified than this. I will be even more undignified than this, and I will be abased in your eye. So David is saying, look, Michal, if you think that this is demeaning, unkingly behavior, you ain't seen nothing yet. This is just a start. This is going to carry on. My reign is going to be characterized by continued self-abasement. What does he mean? To what is he referring? We don't read of him dressing in a linen ephod again. So in what other ways then will he practice a humble, lowly form of kingship calculated to further appall Michal? Well, here are a couple of incidents that might fall into that category. What about his treatment of Mephibosheth? Just a couple of chapters later. And you know the story there, the way in which he inquires to find out if there's a child of Jonathan still around to whom he can show kindness because he's made a promise to Jonathan when Jonathan was still alive. And it emerges that there is this son of Jonathan, Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth is, you remember, that rather pathetic individual. And David is so kind to him and brings him to Jerusalem. And he sits at David's table and dines with the king each day. And That wasn't conventional kingly behavior in the ancient world. Saul's family, the family of the previous king, you didn't show kindness to the family of the previous king. You sought to eliminate them. That's what you did in the ancient world. You saw them as rivals and you sought to eliminate them. I mean, that's how Saul had treated David, wasn't it? Saul saw David as a rival and he sought to eliminate him. And every textbook on kingship that you would pick up in any library in the ancient world would tell you, chapter one, that's what you do. You ruthlessly get rid of anyone who could possibly be a rival. And here's Mephibosheth, and he's a descendant of Saul. He's dangerous. He's got danger written all over him. David, you've got to deal with him. If you're any kind of self-respecting king, you've got to deal with him, David. And David doesn't eliminate him. He's kind to him simply because he's made a promise to his father years ago. What does that matter, David? What's a promise? The man you made it to can't pursue you to carry out your promise. He's dead. What does it matter, David? Just look after your own interests. Look after your own throne. That's what anyone would have said. And again then, to the Michals of this world, it was shameful, demeaning behavior to extend such kindness to Mephibosheth. Or then there's his treatment of Shimei a bit later on. Twice, actually. Remember Shimei? He was the one when David was fleeing Jerusalem because of Absalom's rebellion. Shimei took advantage of David's position of weakness at that point. David is an exile. He's having to flee the city. And Shimei comes out and starts chucking stones at David and ranting at him and saying, this is God getting you back for what you did to Saul. And David's companions advise David, just let us go and wipe this fellow Shimei out. And again, surely convention says, David, you've got to let them do that. This guy needs to be silenced. He's no right to treat you like this. And David says, no, leave him. Let him be. And then, of course, the whole Absalom rebellion passes over and David is able to return to Jerusalem. And one of the first people who meets him when he crosses the Jordan is Shimei, realizing that he's in a bit of an awkward position now because David is back in power. And so he's there groveling before David. And again, David's companions say, well, we'll finish him off now. And again, David stops them, says, no, let him live. This isn't a day for wiping out enemies. And again, it's not the strong kingly behavior that you expected of an ancient Near Eastern monarch. The Michals of this world again would sneer at David being so lenient. His weakness is pathetic. And so those incidents may fall into the category of David becoming even more undignified than this. But perhaps we can go further. This chapter is next door, as your basic mathematical skills will tell you, to chapter 7. And there in chapter 7, famously, God makes a promise to David. And he promises David that he will have a permanent kingdom. Verse 16, your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. It's a remarkable promise. But there's something even more remarkable than that, actually. In that connection of David's house, David's line, David's kingdom lasting forever, in that connection, God promises one special descendant of David. So special that even God himself will claim him as his own son. Not just David's son, but God's son. Verse 14, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. And of course, subsequent prophets look forward to this figure, this special descendant of David, who will reign in a greater sense than David did or any of David's other descendants. And interestingly, as the prophets look forward to this descendant of David, sometimes they refer to him as David. Hosea does. Ezekiel does several times. They prophesy. David's dead by now, but they're prophesying about David ruling. But they're referring to this, if you like, this true David, this ultimate David, who will be David's great descendant. And perhaps then we're permitted to see a fuller meaning in verse 22 here in our passage. Perhaps there's a prophetic dimension here. Perhaps David, in the last analysis, is saying, I, through my descendant, I, the true ultimate David, will be even more undignified than this. Because that true ultimate David we're talking about is, of course, King Jesus. And do you remember how we started our service this evening? In Philippians chapter 2. And do you remember how Paul begins that great hymn, perhaps, song about King Jesus? There in verse 6 of Philippians 2, Paul tells us that he was in the form of God. He didn't simply have a fancy royal robe like Saul. He had the very form, that is, the very outward appearance, the very glory, the very radiance of God himself. And did he flaunt it the way Saul flaunted his royal robe? No, Paul tells us. He made himself nothing. Literally, he emptied himself. And he did so in such a way, in fact, that makes David's donning of a linen ephod seem hardly demeaning and self-abasing at all. He, the one in the form of God, wrapped himself in human form, verse 8 of Philippians 2. And in fact, we know human form at its very weakest and frailest and most helpless point, infancy. He became a crying, milk-sucking baby, unable to talk or walk or do anything for himself. And that seems then, doesn't it, like just the ultimate in self-abasement. But actually, it's only the start. And over Bethlehem's pathetic scene, written in huge letters, are the words even more undignified than this. Because the months go by and the years go by, and eventually we get to a Thursday night, and Jesus is in a room with 12 other men, and they're about to enjoy a meal together, and they need their feet washed, and they're all waiting for some slave to turn up and wash their feet. Why has no slave turned up yet? And then someone turns up at their feet with a basin and a towel, and it's King Jesus. And he's doing this most undignified work, washing the grime, the dung, from between the toes of these men. But even over that upper room is written the words even more undignified than this. Because then comes the next day, the Friday morning. Paul says, doesn't he, there in Philippians 2, that he humbled himself even to the point of death. And on that Friday morning then, this king has metal nails hammered through his hands. He's fixed to a cross and he's left hanging there in shame and agony amidst mockery and scorn. And it's all so humiliating and so demeaning. What kind of king is this? And yet even there, the words can be written across the sky, even more undignified than this, because Friday continues. And we move from the third hour to the sixth hour to the ninth hour. And this king is crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Forsaken not only by men, but by God himself. And there, finally, is the nadir, the rock bottom
of humiliation and self-abasement. And all through that day, of course, the Michals of this world mock, don't they? He's the king of Israel, let him come down. What kind of a king is this? Hanging on a cross, dying. And he really is among the vulgar fellows, numbered with the transgressors, crucified with criminals. This is awesome self-abasement. And saying then there's a trajectory, there's a line, there's a thread from David's words to Michal here in verse 22. I will be even more undignified than this. It takes us through the Mephibosheth incident and through the Shimei incident and on to King Jesus, to Bethlehem, to the upper room, to Golgotha, to the ninth hour. The ultimate in self-abasement, the king. The one who has the right to strut and swagger. The one who can pull that off. The one who is entitled to say, I'm somebody. And he's in the depths, the deepest depths of self-abasement. Clear separation, continued self-abasement, and then one more thing. Counterintuitive success. Counterintuitive success. Perhaps we should take a charitable view of Michal and say, well, she's just being pragmatic. Because at the end of the day, self-abasing kingship doesn't get you very far. If you want to be a successful king, you have to be full of pomp. You have to wear robes. You have to flaunt. Perhaps we should attribute that pragmatism to Michal. But notice that David begs to differ on that point. Because he continues in verse 22, he says, I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be abased in your eyes. And then he adds, but by the female servants of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor. And David is saying then, look, you might be appalled by the lowliness and the plainness and the humbleness of this scene. But there are others who can look upon me in all this ordinariness and recognize that I am a true king. And recognize that I am to be honored. And that I am to be submitted to. And being a lowly king will not consign me to the garbage heap of history. But I will be successful through being lowly. And it's very interesting, in fact, that we're told there in verse 23, aren't we? Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. And then we're told in the next chapter about David having this line that will go on forever. In other words, the house of Saul ends here. The pompous kingship, the swaggering kingship, the flaunting kingship, it ends at the end of chapter 6. The lowly kingship. The royal robe discarding kingship, the humble kingship, it's going to go on forever. And when the great king comes in lowliness, there are those out there who, like the servant girls here, recognize through the lowliness that this is a great king. And shepherds turn up at the manger. And they recognize that this is a great king to be honored. And even at Golgotha, where the self-abasement is so deep and the concealment of his glory so thick, even there you have a criminal saying, remember me when you come into your kingdom. You have a centurion saying, this is the Son of God. Even there, you have people like these servant girls seeing through the lowliness that this is indeed the king. In the last analysis, Michal's sarcasm in verse 20 becomes wonderfully true. She says, how the king of Israel honoured himself today. And that's what the soldiers are saying at Golgotha, isn't it? How this king is honouring himself now. What a rubbish king. And remember how Jesus says in John 12, of the cross, the hour is coming when the Son of Man will be glorified at the cross. Where he'll be most abased, he will be most glorified. Because as he goes on to say in that chapter there, I will draw all men to myself. And throughout the last 2,000 years, whereas all the pompous kingdoms and empires of this world have eventually fallen, eventually been consigned to the garbage heap, the kingdom of the crucified has spread and spread and spread. So that today there are millions of people in this world who honour, who glorify, who worship the King who lowered himself to the cross. What a wonderful paradox. And I just want to close asking then, are you one of those? Are you with these servant girls? Do you see in the lowly King Jesus, the great King to whom you must bow the knee? Are you with these servant girls? Are you with the shepherds? Are you with the centurion and the soldiers at Golgotha? Do you see in the self-abasing King of glory the one to whom you want to give the rest of your life and on whom you want to stake your entire eternal welfare? Come and bow before this counterintuitively successful king and adore him as Lord and Saviour. Amen. Let's pray.